This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. And I gotta tell you, it's a wacky weekend for sports. Both Final Fours getting set to crank out the NCAA's terrific twos on the men's side. You got George Mason. Whoa! How'd they find their way to Indianapolis? You can't make this stuff up. You know what I'm saying? Major League Baseball season begins tomorrow. Got Barry Bonds saying he's ready to play. What do you think? Does the end justify the steroids is what that means? Does anybody care? Does Henry Aaron care? Major League Soccer begins its season today. Today! Somebody somewhere is probably playing arena football, too. I don't know where to start. Let's go to the phones. We got Jennifer from Van Nuys. You're up on Only a Game.
Hey, Bill. How's it going?
I'm good, good, good. Jennifer, what's up?
Well, first I have to ask you, since you just mentioned it, are you embracing the Mason?
I am absolutely embracing the Mason. There's no question about it.
No, UCLA all the way, babe. UCLA all the way.
No, I'm sorry, you're wrong. It's George Mason. It's their year. They're on a mission, Jennifer.
No. Okay, so Bill... Like, what is with that World Baseball non-classic? I mean, our game has been hijacked, okay? It used to be our game. Now, like, it's not even a pastime anymore.
What do you got against people from other countries, Jennifer?
Oh, come on. The world is beating us in our own game now, Bill. What is this country coming to?
Sorry, Jennifer. I mean, that's the bell.
Like,
that's the bell.
Cuba,
she's not paying any attention to the bell.
Okay, UCLA all the way.
That was just great. We got Fred from Framingham. You're up on Only a Game, Fred.
Bill, how are you?
I'm pretty good.
Well, I'll tell you, the sun is shining, the birds are out, but I got to tell you, I'm a little worried about these Red Sox.
This is a very common ailment, Fred. Take two aspirin, go to bed, and don't call me.
No, but I got to talk to somebody about this, Bill, and, you know, I think this is something you got to respond to. I mean, we got a guy now playing center field. He's a serial or something. I don't know what that's about. We lost Johnny Damon to the Yankees. David Wells is here, then he's not here. I can't even follow it all.
Sorry. I dropped off for a minute there, Fred.
I'm worried about spring training, too. We can talk about that, too.
All right, Fred, I'm obviously not going to get you off the Red Sox. I did my best. I'm just going to have to wish you well.
We'll talk by the All-Star break, Bill.
Okay.
I'll bet you'll come around by then.
Yeah, Fred, don't count on it. Next up, we got Buck from Chicago on the line. Buck, what's up?
Bill, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. Yourself?
I'm doing okay, but I must say I'm a little peeved about the fact that with all the resources available to Only a Game, and sports journalism in general, the fact that this Sunday, the single greatest night in the history of sports entertainment, in the history of maybe the United States of America, and maybe the history of mankind.
Oh, I feel something idiosyncratic coming on, Buck. What's on your mind?
I don't see anything idiosyncratic about WrestleMania 22, the big time, and the fact that sports journalism just always, again, for the 22nd year, just seems to turn its back on WrestleMania and is not giving it the coverage it deserves.
You know, Buck, the key word was right in the middle of the sentence for you there. You know what it was?
What's that?
Sports.
Right.
You can't call it a sport when the outcome is already decided. See, a sport is when you don't know which guy is going to win.
Who's going to win between John Cena and Triple H? Who's going to win that match? Who's going to win between Booker T and the scariest man alive, the Boogeyman?
Okay, Buck, you ready?
Ready.
Ready? 3, 2, 1.
What's that?
That's the sound of me hanging up on you, Buck. We got time for just a few more calls here. Rod from San Francisco, you're on Only a Game. What's on your mind?
Hey, Bill, first time, long time.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say I'm really, 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 really angry right now.
I'm sorry to hear that.
We have a travesty of justice going on right now. Barry Bonds should not be indicted, investigated in anything except in the Hall of Fame.
You know what? I tell you something, Rod, seriously now. I'm glad I'm not the commissioner of baseball because somebody's got to do something.
Yeah, then we'd be playing soccer. Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Rod, you're a long-time listener.
Oh, yeah. That's a long-time suffering listener.
That's great. That's great to hear. Now, I got to say, the tragedy in all this is Barry Bonds has turned a lot of people off to baseball. It's breaking people's hearts, and, you know, that's really sad.
I'm sorry. All I could hear with all that stuff was, I'm a loser.
Oh, what a shame. Lost the loser's call. Let's take another one here. Tim from Maryland, you're up next on Only a Game.
Hello, Bill. It's Tim Kirkchin with ESPN.
Tim, this is great. There is a God. You don't know what I've been going through taking these calls up here. I had a guy call in, say he thought everybody in baseball except Barry Bonds was using steroids. Do you believe that?
That's a bit of an overstatement, Bill, but I think we do have an issue here with steroids, and it's getting bigger and bigger with the way this investigation has started. And I'm a little worried where this might be going, because the couple 300 guys who may have been on steroids, we may find out is double that amount if they go forward and do well with this investigation. We'll have to see about all this.
The investigation that you mention is being headed by George Mitchell. The commissioner has come under a good deal of criticism for choosing Mr. Mitchell. Did he have any choice as far as having an investigation? Should he have chosen somebody better to head it?
Well, I actually think he picked the right guy to head it, because I think George Mitchell has an idea what baseball is about. And even though he's got his ties to the Red Sox, I think the fact that he is one of the congressmen in his own way, one of their guys, I think this takes the congressional pressure off of baseball to some degree. And I also think George Mitchell will do the best job possible. However, Bill, I don't know if he's going to be able to do a good job, period. I don't think anybody can, because let's face it, he's going to need tremendous cooperation from major league players on this, and executives, and all sorts of other people. And as far as I can tell, since this is not a criminal investigation, he's not going to have the power of subpoena. He's just going to have the power of request. And I'm not sure a whole lot of players are going to be running forward, you know, to testify and to help him out in this case. That's my concern for him.
To what extent is the whole Bonds story, including not only the investigation, but the ongoing denials of Victor Conti, the debate over whether Major League Baseball should celebrate Bonds' homer number 715 when it comes, is this all likely to overshadow what happens on the field this spring?
You know, I really don't think so, Bill. I remember when this came up a couple of years ago, I said, great, we just ruined the baseball season. And as it turned out, it didn't ruin the baseball season. Last year, similar story. Black cloud over the game the whole year, broke attendance records. And I'm sorry, I just did not walk through the stands and have people talking about steroids 24 hours a day. That's not the way it works. Now, we are in a little bit more of a serious situation here. We've got a book out that is so specific, it's frightening. And now we've got a formal investigation led by the commissioner. It is a different situation this time, but I refuse to believe that the game will not overcome this, because I think it will, and I certainly hope it will, because the last thing I want to do is chase steroid stories all year instead of covering the game.
Let's talk a little about the game, Tim. The Chicago White Sox will be trying to repeat as champs. Gee, that has a peculiar ring to it, doesn't it?
Well, it really does, but I think try is the operative word here. I think they have a chance to do this. They got better in the offseason, Bill, and this is rare for a world championship team to basically not lose a whole lot and then start to add people, and that's what they did. Javier Vasquez is a quality major league starting pitcher. Jim Thome is going to go to the Hall of Fame with another 100 or 150 home runs, and I think he has the potential to do that, given that he's finally healthy again after last season. So I think the White Sox are the odds-on favorite, certainly to win the division, maybe to win the American League, but the way baseball has gone the last basically 8 years, Bill, with different champions and everything else, I'm not so sure we should put anybody in as a favorite, certainly not this year.
Elsewhere in the National League, the Mets are once again trying the time-honored method of improving that ball club. They've spent an awful lot of money since last fall. How much better are they?
I think they're demonstrably better, Bill. Their offense, which really had a couple of holes last year, has really been fixed. Paul LaDuca behind the plate is an upgrade defensively, certainly. Carlos Delgado at first base is a huge upgrade. They had the least production out of first base the last 2 years of any first base quartet in the major leagues. And, you know, with some of the other people that they've added to that club, specifically Billy Wagner in the bullpen, they plugged some holes that had to be plugged. I've got them going to the playoffs, and the Mets haven't been to the playoffs in a little while, so they really have to go out and do it on the field, but they certainly have the people to do it now.
Any place else that you're anticipating a great improvement?
Well, I think, like, for instance, the Brewers are going to be better. I think they're even going to be a contender for a short time in that division. I think the Pirates are going to get a lot better, but not enough to win any sort of division. I think the Giants are going to make a big jump from last year, assuming, of course, Barry Bonds plays 100 to 120 games. I think Oakland is going to be the best team in the American League West this year, which would be not a sizable jump, but a jump nonetheless. So this is a great part about baseball this year, Bill. There are a lot of teams out there that have a chance to make the playoffs, and there are very, very few, if any, dominant teams out there. And I think we're going to have a lot of teams in it all the way through September this year, and that's what we're looking for.
Tim, regardless of the fact that you picked the U.S. team to win the inaugural World Baseball Classic, I'm going to give you the opportunity, an April opportunity, I'll grant you, to pick October's opponents. What do you think?
Well, I wasn't the only one to miss out on the USA. And I also picked Japan, by the way, to be the dark horse in this whole thing. Of course, my colleague Peter Gammons picked Japan to win it from the beginning. Yeah, how did he know that?
I don't know. He probably gets a bonus.
Right. Well, here's what I'm doing on the picks this year. I'm saying the Yankees win the division, the Red Sox win the wild card, the White Sox win the Central, and the A's win the West. In the National League, the Braves win the division, the Mets win the wild card, the Cardinals win the Central, and the Giants win the West. For now, and this could change tomorrow, I've got the Yankees playing the Cardinals in the World Series, and I've got the Yankees, assuming they straighten out their pitching between now and October, are going to win the World Series this year. So write it down, Bill, and when I'm wrong, go ahead and laugh at me in October. I can't wait.
Tim Kirchen of ESPN joins me for Baseball Talk from time to time. And hold on just a second, Tim. I got another call. I guess for some reason we're still taking them. Pat from Indianapolis, you're on Only a Game.
Excuse me here. It's the week of the Final Four, and you want to talk about baseball? All those thrilling topics like the double switch, the throw over to first, save it. The great tried-and-true baseballisms, the crack of the bat, the smell of the glove, the sting of the injectable steroid, they'll still be there next week. Let's go back to basketball.
Pat, I'm sure you're right. I'm just new to all this call-in business, and maybe it's messed up my priorities a little bit, I guess. Bear with me. We'll get the Final Four just a little bit later. Tim, you still there?
Yes, I can't believe how rude one of my colleagues was. Does he not know that this is my spot and we're talking about baseball? How dare him interrupt me in a situation like this?
Well, now that I'm talking to you, Tim, I agree. That was just absolutely indefensible. Thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Talk to you soon.
It's 19. I'm Bill Littlefield coming up on Only a Game. Stone Cold Slap Happy Shakespearean Smackdowns. What? But first, the madness of March will linger for a few more days. Those of you who picked George Mason, LSU, UCLA, and Florida to fill out the final four slots in your NCAA men's tourney bracket may want to skip the next few minutes, since you probably already know what's going to happen this weekend. But to the rest who foolishly picked, oh, I don't know, Duke, UConn, Gonzaga to make it this far, don't worry. Joining me on the line from Indianapolis, home of the men's Final Four, is Pat Forty of ESPN.com. Hello, Pat, and thank you for your patience.
I'm happy to be here, Bill.
How many times did you hear, hey, how your bracket's looking this week?
Many times, and my bracket looks the same every time. Terrible. Total disaster.
Well, it makes me feel much better that an expert has come out that way.
No, I'm no expert, at least in terms of this field this year. The one thing I did say at the beginning, I thought that there was a possibility for unprecedented chaos, and by golly, we've had it. I just didn't know which teams were going to get in.
Sports journalists think hyperbole is the best thing that's happened since the Gutenberg press, and experts were quick to say the run by George Mason was the biggest upset in the NCAA tournament's history. With a few days of perspective, does that claim still hold?
You know, I really can't think of one that was more amazing. I mean, you know, we've had, you know, an 11 seed make it before, but that was LSU. That was a big-time program from a big-time conference. George Mason has no pedigree. There is nothing to look at and say, yeah, that's a hoop school. For them to have done what they've done, I'll go ahead and put it up there and say that is the most surprising Final Four run I've ever seen.
Well, does the surprise go on? What chance do the George Mason Patriots have against Florida tonight?
Well, for the fifth consecutive game, I'm picking against them. and it's worked out awfully well so far.
Yeah, splendid.
Yeah. you know, I think Florida's my pick to win it all just because they have everything you want in a national championship kind of team. I mean, they have great size, great athleticism, a very underrated point guard in Torian Green, a little bit of depth. They shoot it outside. They go inside. They play well together. They have a coach who's been to a Final Four. George Mason, if they can beat Connecticut, they can beat Florida. But I think at some point in time it ends, and I think it ends tonight.
Florida is led by center Joakim Noah, who has been arguably the best player in the tournament. He's sort of come from nowhere for most casual fans, but should anybody be surprised by his success given his lineage?
Yeah. Dad, former French Open champion Yannick Noah, they share a little bit of the showman's personality. Joakim loves the spotlight, loves to play to the crowd, great, bubbly, outgoing guy, very interesting. His mom is a former Miss Sweden. Grew up in France, has lived in New York, visits Cameroon where his grandfather's from, speaks, you know, several languages, and a heck of a prospect. I don't think anybody really looked at him as a great player or an NBA kind of guy, and then all of a sudden this year he just has blown up, and he is legitimate. He's a great talent.
I almost forgot about the other game tonight, Pat. We've got UCLA against LSU, and I may be wrong, but it seems to me the only way either team scores 70 points is if they shorten the shot clock down to about 15 seconds. Have I got that right?
Yeah, well, then they'd still have to make the shots, and I don't know whether that's going to happen. Now, this game has Michigan State-Wisconsin 2000 Final Four written all over it, where I think that one was 19-17 at halftime, and Michigan State exploded to score 53 and win in the second half. You know, it's going to be a grinder. There's no doubt about it. That's the way UCLA wants to play, and LSU is comfortable playing that way, too. So it's not going to make for the most compelling basketball, but you know what? The winner still goes to the national championship game and has a chance to win it all.
LSU may have the best nickname still left in the tournament. That would be Glenn Big Baby Davis. He's 6'9", 310 pounds, may also be one of the biggest personalities in the Final Four. Are reporters rooting for the Tigers to make it to the championship so they'll have more of the quotable Big Baby?
That would be a dream. The Sunday between games is one of the great reporter opportunities because you get guys for like 45 minutes in a room in a small breakout room, and the Big Baby room would be packed if it came to that because he is a treat. He is, his personality is as big as he is at the Southeastern Conference tournament. He went on a long ramble on the podium after one of the games about comparing basketball to like when you break up with your girlfriend and you're trying to impress her and win her back, and his teammates were like almost literally putting the shepherd's hook around his neck and trying to get him off the stage, and he would not stop. I mean, this guy, talk about a guy who loves the spotlight. Fans will be in love with him. The media already is.
All right, we know you're picking against George Mason again, having apparently learned nothing. Who do you think wins this thing?
I think Florida does. I think Florida beats UCLA on Monday night. I think UCLA can frustrate LSU into taking enough bad shots and win a really, you know, tight, low-scoring game. I think their guards can kind of dictate and control what's going on. But I think if they run up against Florida on Monday night, the athletic size of Florida carries the day, and Billy Donovan cuts down the nets.
The women have their Final Four in Boston this weekend. It seems like the ACC has decided to redo its tournament by sending three teams. How do you see things playing out in the hub?
I got to be with North Carolina. I think they've had a fantastic season, and I love the personality of Ivory Latta. I've liked the way they have played through the tournament, and I think they're going to keep going.
Pat Forde covers college basketball for ESPN.com, and he is our regular hoops analyst here on Only a Game. Pat, thanks again.
My pleasure, Bill.
Join us next week on Only a Game when I'll explore how the WNBA and the NCAA are working together to promote women's basketball. For more on this week's stories, links to a panoply of podcasts, or a look at our most recent photo galleries, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Professional wrestling, according to author Thomas Hackett, is the logical outcome of America's seemingly insatiable appetite for belligerence and buffoonery. This is one of the assertions apparent in Mr. Hackett's new book, Slap Happy: Pride, Prejudice, and Professional Wrestling. Another is that for many fans, watching wrestlers act out their preposterous egoism is a comforting escape from a frightening reality. sports, entertainment, pathology, sociology. Mr. Hackett joins me now from New York to help clarify the confusion. Mr. Hackett, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
You maintain that in a world where investment professionals don't bother to examine Enron's fantastic claims and a former bodybuilder gets elected governor of California essentially on the strength of the celebrity that he achieved by taking steroids, it isn't really fair to characterize pro wrestling as phony. Have I got that argument right?
Well, I mean, it's phony in the way that pretty much everything else is phony. But I think it's real in the sense that something real is and important is at stake for these boys, for these fans, and for the wrestlers themselves. You know, they're not really competing athletically, but they really are competing for attention. That is the competition. It's a very real competition for them, and it's, you know, enough of one that dozens, it may be up towards 100 now, have lost their lives in this, what some would consider a trivial pursuit.
I want to get back to that attention business, that really is the point. For some of these fans that you talk to, just the fact that pro wrestling is on television certifies that it's important and that it's worth striving for.
Yeah, exactly. You know, wrestlers were sort of presented as sort of mock celebrities. Their machismo was sort of meant to be campy, and yet, paradoxically, they're taken as the real thing, as real celebrities and as real men. And, you know, it's not only wrestling fans who feel that, you know, that these people have been certified, but I think it's just, you know, we in the culture. Newsweek put wrestling on the cover. And when I told friends that I was interviewing The Rock, that instantly certified me. I mean, my friends suddenly took me seriously.
Yeah.
Until I had interviewed The Rock, I was doing something sort of weird and aberrant. But once I said, oh, I'm going to interview The Rock, they were like, oh, wow. That's, you know, that was a feat. I had accomplished something.
Well, and your friends weren't the only ones who felt that way. Describe what you saw when that pro wrestler known as The Rock entered a restaurant where several Orlando Magic players, real certifiable athletes, including Grant Hill, were having lunch.
Yeah, that was an interesting moment. I was sitting there, and I knew who they were, and I'd gotten there early, and I was waiting for The Rock, and by the way, his name is Dwayne Johnson. I sat there in the restaurant really trying to figure out what I should call him. Do you call someone The Rock or The or
maybe
Rock
Mr. Rock?
Mr. Rock. I had no idea. I really was. So finally, I did decide to go with Dwayne, and he walked in, and instantly these real celebrities were snapped to attention, and they were quite in awe of him. You know, he was someone who played what they are. He played pretend for a living, and yet in the sort of, you know, in an image culture, he's more legitimate in a way than they are.
Mm.
And not only that, I mean, they sort of deferred to me, too. Not that they were talking, but there was a kind of like, I had no idea I was sitting next to somebody important.
That gets instant status rubbed off.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of the fans you encountered absolutely refused to agree that pro wrestling was fake. What exactly was their argument?
Well, I think it was, you know, that they wanted to believe in something, and they wanted they, you know, once you admit that something's fake, then I think you're saying that what they believe in isn't worth believing in. You know, I think it's akin to a religious belief. I mean, you could say, you know, I don't want to digress into talking about a religion, but you could cast doubt on any of the sort of far-fetched things in any religion. And if you had to put it to the scrutiny of logic, it would break down. But, you know, the belief is genuine. The belief that, you know, you can remake yourself, that you can become something larger than life, that you can sort of triumph over adversity. These are very real beliefs for these fans. They don't want to discard them as much as they, I think, honestly do. You know, they see the artifice of it, but they want to hold on to the convictions behind that.
Kind of like believing that the actor dressed up as a suffering old man, King Lear, really is suffering, at least for the length of time that it takes for the drama to unfold.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's really no different. I mean, you know, theater is all a matter of suspension of disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, if we believe that there is such a person as Hamlet or King Lear, you know, all he is essentially is words on a page, right? those two figures, and yet we believe that they're real in a sense. I mean, we believe that they that these characters, these literary characters, have lives. And you just say, well, Hamlet's just fictional, sort of, you know, negates the whole achievement of Shakespeare.
Of course, one of the things that gets some of these wrestlers in trouble is they become unable to differentiate between the person they really are, the Dwayne, and the Rock, that person they become when the lights go up and the loud music begins.
Yeah, that's true. I would say The Rock doesn't, Dwayne Johnson doesn't fall into that category, actually. I think he was remarkably clear-headed and level-headed about it all, which is really, you know, maybe one reason why he's succeeded so spectacularly. Mm. But a lot of them do get caught up in the pathology. And in wrestling, it's called living the gimmick, and that the lines start to break down between who they are and who they perform, who they pretend to be.
Well, you describe 1 5-year period during which some 60 pro wrestlers or guys who were former pro wrestlers under the age of 45 died. Is this a direct result of that confusion you're talking about, or what are some of the other occupational hazards of the profession?
Yeah, I do think it's a direct result. And I think that figure I cite is conservative. I think it's up towards 100, really. It got a little hard to count because, you know, not all of them are famous and they have a tenuous relationship to wrestling. Some of them do. Yeah, they got lost in the image, lost in their own fabrications about themselves, and they couldn't find their way back to who they really were, or they were afraid to, because who they really were was someone who hadn't quite made it or whose glory days were behind them. So they generally got lost in drug addictions, really. And some of those drug addictions are obviously helped along by the work they do, which is very brutal. I mean, that isn't fake. They really do get hurt. They really do bleed. A chair shot, you know, they get hit with regular chairs, and a chair shot really does hurt. So they, you know, after their shows, they take painkillers, and it becomes part of the life.
My guest is Thomas Hackett, author of Slap Happy, Pride, Prejudice, and Professional Wrestling. You're listening to Only a Game. Of some of the young men who follow the WWE, which is, of course, the wrestling organization most prominent in this country at this point, you write, "I wished more of us could find as much pure joy in our culture as they found in pro wrestling." But don't you also kind of hope those guys will grow up?
Oh, sure, sure. But, you know, for a few years, it's a lot of fun. I think it's great. I would actually say less the WWE fans than the fans that I was encountering at the independent shows that I was going to. But it was a real sort of giddy, spirited event where all their insecurities just, you know, were left outside. They just had a ball. And, you know, these are very often uncertain, insecure, you know, young men who don't were looking for a way in life, looking to establish themselves as men. And they're very insecure about that. And they go into these arenas and they yell and they shout obscenities and they just have a ball. I think it was a kind of a wonderful thing for them. And yes, they do grow out of it. And generally, they're kind of ashamed that they were ever a part of it when they do grow out of it, you know, because at this point, they now have girlfriends and they realize that they were spending the bulk of their teenage years hanging out with other boys. They try to distance themselves as much as possible from those years.
A lot of these guys you described not only spent their teenage years hanging out with other boys, they spent those years, at least at the wrestling shows, screaming vile insults at the women who were present.
Yeah, the insults are pretty vile. And they seem vile when you put them on the page. And yet when you're there, and I don't mean to make any excuses, when you're there, it doesn't actually seem vile. It actually seems kind of affectionate, as strange as it may sound. And the other thing you got to remember is that it's part of the culture, the slanging, the trash talking, you know, the swearing. And they do it as much to themselves, and they welcome it when it's directed at themselves. So that when a wrestler, a female wrestler perhaps, or a male wrestler, turns that around and starts calling them the vilest of names, they've hit the jackpot. Yeah, that's actually the best possible moment for them, is to get singled out and ridiculed. And sometimes a boy will be ridiculed for 10, 15 minutes by a wrestler. And, you know, what other place in American culture can that happen, where you are suddenly the star of the show for, you know, sometimes 10, 15 minutes? The show is about you.
Thomas Hackett is the author of Slap Happy, Pride, Prejudice, and Professional Wrestling, published by HarperCollins. He spoke to me from New York. Mr. Hackett, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Charlie Pierce. Ahead on Only a Game, two enterprising surfboard makers forego foam and settle upon cedar. But first, this week's news with that two-legged sports encyclopedia, Bill Littlefield. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Charlie.
Major League Baseball announced this week that it will conduct its own steroids investigation under the leadership of former U.S. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. I suppose, Bill, that you think this should preserve the sanctity of your quaint little game, eh?
I think George Mitchell is the perfect choice for this, Charlie. He's the head of the Disney Corporation, parent company of ESPN. Who approved this? Dick Cheney? Donald Rumsfeld? Mrs. Halberton has been involved in this?
And anyway, this week, Major League Baseball says it probably won't do much to celebrate Barry Bonds moving past Babe Ruth and into second place on the all-time home runs list, but that it will probably formally celebrate when he passes Henry Aaron. Is this a race thing, Bill?
Well, I love this story, Charlie, because even as Major League Baseball makes this announcement, sponsors are packing their bags and heading for the hills. Bank of America, for example, says, forget it. All bets are off. We don't want anything to do with this guy. But there may be a gigantic syringe paraded out onto the field in one float.
Absolutely. This week, Pete Rose said he's in favor of punishing baseball players who get caught using steroids. Does Pete have an opinion that we're aware of about players who gamble on baseball and use amphetamines?
Pete announced that he'd been suspended for 18 years, and he thought these other guys should be suspended for at least 18 years. And that seems perfectly as reasonable as anything Pete Rose has said for the last 18 years.
And since we're talking about the taxation of stupid people, the Boston Red Sox will become the first major league team to have its logo on lottery tickets.
Yeah,
good idea.
It's a great idea. We don't yet know what other addictions the Red Sox will be associated with, but I'm watching the wire every day to find out.
Today, in the men's Final Four, George Mason takes on Florida, and LSU plays UCLA. Now, I know every year you pick your brackets based on the color of the uniforms. These were your picks, weren't they?
Yeah, you see all these Lincoln logs at my feet?
Yes.
This great pile of broken Lincoln logs, those were my brackets. Anybody who says they picked George Mason to be in the Final Four is lying. And it's that simple. And that having been said, I hope they win because I love it when experts fumble around trying to figure out how all this happened.
Well, I'm glad you say that because I'm going to give you yet another opportunity. In the women's Final Four, Maryland plays North Carolina tomorrow, followed by the contest between LSU and Duke.
Mm-hmm.
Duke and Carolina in the finals?
Carolina and Duke in the finals, and Carolina wins because Ivory Latta is the poster child for women's basketball throughout the rest of this season and until somebody else takes her place next year.
Elsewhere in the Atlantic Coast Conference, Duke president Richard Broadhead suspended the men's lacrosse team after allegations of sexual assault at a March 13th party attended by as many as 40 lacrosse players. Would the president have done the same thing to the school's basketball team in, oh, I don't know, March?
Well, the president almost didn't do it to the lacrosse team, Charlie. They actually played two games after this party, this ill-considered celebration that the lacrosse team had, and it wasn't until fairly large numbers of people on campus began appearing on the president's lawn and banging pots with spoons at all hours of the night to keep him awake that he finally said, gee, maybe it shouldn't be business as usual here on the campus.
You already mentioned this as one of the 11 billion reasons you hate the National Football League, but this week the league voted to curtail seriously all touchdown celebrations. But for renegades like yourself, there's hope. Celebrated celebrator Jad Johnson is already devising a number of legal celebrations for next season. Do you have any idea what they are?
Well, I know that some have been stipulated in this multi-page document in front of me. Now, listen carefully, so in case you are involved in the NFL, you'll know what you can do after you score your touchdowns. Spikes, dunks, Lambo leaps, spins, dances, and simple celebrations will all be tolerated by the poobahs of the National Football League. However, you will not be allowed to cradle the ball as if it were a baby, pretend to change its diaper, pull a Sharpie out of your pants, and sign anything. All that's out.
Philadelphia Eagles linebacker Donnie Jones was arrested in Miami on Sunday because he wouldn't stop dancing in the streets.
Another NFL, no fun league, even in the streets.
Come on out around the world. Are you ready for a brand new beat, but not in Miami?
Not here, wait, not now.
I'm concerned about off the field assaults, felonies, and mayhem, but God, I didn't think dancing in the streets was quite such a plague.
Yeah, it apparently is a very big problem in Miami, and I guess it was spring break and the authorities got carried away.
Well, Bill, Jeff Gordon on the NASCAR circuit was fined $10,000 after he shoved Matt Kenseth, did a little rubbing following Sunday's NASCAR race at Bristol Motor Speedway, the craziest place on the NASCAR tour because it's so small. Now, was Gordo checked up in front of Matty, or was Kenseth tired to a little push?
All I know is that Jeff Gordon should be commended for keeping his head even when he was losing his temper. You'll notice in the films of this, he kept his helmet on when he pushed the other
guy. He's a smart boy, isn't he?
Any punch back at him would have resulted in broken knuckles, and, you know, Gordon's no fool.
He's a real smart boy, yeah, that Jeff Gordon. I know folks don't like him around the circuit, but I've always thought he was a hell of a kid. Now, I don't even need to preface this question because I know that your intellect is finally attuned to the smallest vibrations.
I'm finally going
to
pay
attention.
In
the soccer world, a sparrow cannot fall from the sky in Cameroon without your eye being on it.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of Nigerian soccer officials' attempt to remove unfair bribery from the sport?
It's another obvious example of soccer leading the way, my friend. Above board corruption. In Nigeria, the referees have been instructed to keep taking the bribes, but not to let the bribes affect the way they call the game. And referees, I'm quoting now, referees should only pretend to fall for the bait, but make sure the result doesn't favor those offering the bribe. That's what they were told by the person who runs the league in Nigeria. So keep the money, and you know what happens to people who do that to gangsters?
They disappear.
I just don't know if being a Nigerian referee is a great career choice right now.
Well, as an old Texas politician, you say if you can't drink their whiskey, take their money, vote against them anyway.
I think
what's good is it being in politics?
Yep.
Bill Littlefield teaches English at Vindaloo College, and I join him each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Charlie.
My discussion with Bill last week about a twice-caught bass that would have been a record breaker if the guy who caught it had brought it to an official scale encouraged numbers of listeners to write. From New Jersey, Bonnie emailed, "How do you know it was the same fish someone had previously caught? What, do they wear name tags? I have no idea about that." Tom Wanner emailed to take issue with my characterization of the fish in question as dumb. "I'd say he was smart," Mr. Wanner wrote. "It got 2 15 minutes of fame, while each fisherman only got 1 15 minutes of fame, which is almost an entire hour of fame for the lot of them." Mark Berman, who hears the show on WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, wrote to weigh in on the issue as well. "The fish may be a real-world example of the handicap theory of evolutionary biology," he contended. "This fish has survived at least two brushes, with the hook and the media. The female fish he is trying to impress probably is impressed. This is similar to the peacock's tail, brightly colored northern cardinals, and perhaps NASCAR." Regarding Charlie Schroeder's story last week on dune buggy racing, F.R. Coburn Jr., a WBUR listener, emailed to ask, "What in the world are you doing glorifying the thrill of driving vehicles amid dune ecology? What's next? The pumped-up feeling that comes from winning at cockfighting? Did someone tell you you needed to reach the NASCAR demographic?" Charlie, we already reached the NASCAR demographic. That's why I'm on the show. Phyllis Buckwalter, who hears Only a Game on KNOW in St. Paul, Minnesota, worries that we've pumped up the volume! "I live in a condo," she writes, "and the music you play between segments is too loud. I have to keep turning the volume down to avoid bothering my neighbors. Otherwise, your show is perfect." Thanks a lot, Phyllis! Whether you're in Daytona or Dedham, and whichever way you're turning the volume knob, you can send your comments on Only a Game to WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Since the world's largest manufacturer of foam surfboard blanks announced its demise last December, some builders have turned their attention to wood, the material from which the very first surfboards were constructed. Wooden boards are more difficult and expensive to make, but the craft is evolving and becoming more modernized. This past winter, Only a Game's Shannon Mullen traveled to Maine and met two surfers who hope to keep the sport of surfing in touch with its roots.
Mike LaVecchia and Rich Blendell live and work in York, Maine, in a house on a high bluff overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. They're outside on this windy winter day, checking out the surf and reveling in their good fortune.
Don't tell anybody. But this spot, we get storms, you know, in the winter from the northeast. This is not northeast wind, but when we do get a northeast wind, this is like one of the only protected spots that you can actually surf. We were surfing the other day. It was like 14 degrees. The wind was blowing hard, but the waves are really good. So,
because on a good day, there's nobody out here. We got the whole place to ourselves.
The backyard action on the blue-gray ocean barreling in off the Atlantic is one of the reasons LaVecchia and Blendell chose this spot to set up their company, Grain Surfboards, which builds hollow boards made from sustainably harvested red and white cedar. The duo decided to go into business last spring. Neither had any formal woodworking training, aside from some experience building wooden boats, but wooden boards seemed like a natural.
People have been surfing wood surfboards since the beginning of surfing. When you think about riding waves, when you think about the first boats that were built, I mean, it's all built out of wood. Wood is what, you know, how things developed. Your house, your boat, you heat your, whatever.
To demonstrate their methods, Mike and Rich take me inside to their living room, which doubles as an office.
Actually, let me just show you real quick a board.
To my surprise, the building process begins on a computer. Rich pulls up some board specs on a program that draws frame cross-sections and keel patterns.
Here's an 8-footer we're working on. I basically entered in all the data, all the different thicknesses and that sort of thing, and I, you know, can produce outlines for different boards. And then we can print these out onto paper right here.
The rest of the process is hands-on, and it happens downstairs in the basement workshop.
Got an arrow, and you got to watch your head.
The paper frame printout is glued onto a long, thin piece of marine plywood to serve as a guide for sawing out a board's cross-sections.
What I'm going to do next is to cut this out, cut these shapes out, and when I'm done, hopefully they'll all interlock together, and what we'll have is the skeleton framework of a surfboard.
Marine plywood makes a lot of sense. It's light, it's rot-proof. I mean, cedar is rot-proof, but this stuff will last forever.
Rich goes to work on the spine and cross-sections. He glues them together, and when he's done, the frame looks like the skeleton of a fish.
This is the inside of the board that you're never going to see. You'll never see it once the board is finished, but this basically defines the exterior shape of the board. But it's all inside. It's like an airplane wing or a boat frame.
When it's at this stage, this is the first time that you're able to see the curvature of the board and the, you know, the crown of the deck. But you have to look at it lengthwise like this in order to visualize how the skin will go on it.
Next up, arranging the planks to design the board's grain patterns. Quarter-inch red and white cedar is cut lengthwise and laid out to create what they call book-matched patterns. Then the planks are glued together to form the top deck and bottom of the board.
This was like that. So we cut it down the middle and planed them. And now you've got two pieces of wood that are a mirror image of each other. So when you put them together, especially if you have a really interesting grain pattern,
you get very, like, crazy shapes.
Yeah. You get this nice symmetry to the way the wood lays out. But something's funky. These two go together. See that?
Yeah.
Right?
So this should go there.
The way, like, now that, when that's all glued up and all epoxied, see that cool shape?
Once the cedar is laid out, Rich spritzes it with some water to see what the grain patterns will look like when the board is finished.
See, now it starts to get really iridescent in there.
These look great. I mean, I really like these two, actually.
I like this dark area. Dude, that is great.
Besides being pretty, cedar is also very practical.
The reason we use cedar it's grown here on the East Coast, and it's a really common wood for boat building. It's extremely rot resistant, and it's very light. You really need to use a very lightweight wood for surfboards, and balsa is really probably the most common wood.
But it's boring.
It's boring. It's not very, the grain is not very interesting, and you can't buy it locally. You know, it's coming from, I don't know where.
Ecuador, but, Central America.
Right. So we wanted to kind of use a wood that had a more of a New England, you know, Maine kind of tradition to it. And cedar just made a lot of sense.
Once the bottom skin is ready, the rails and top planks go on, and the wood is planed and hand-sanded for the finish. Mike and Rich say they can turn out about 2 boards a week if they work nonstop. Grain boards cost between $1,100 and $1,400 each, and they freely admit that wooden boards might not be for everyone.
You know, for a beginner, you're much better off to go and spend $300 on an entry-level surfboard and get out there and surf for a few months and see if you like it.
But for people who are ready for a foam alternative and can afford it...
What I feel when I surf a board like this is it's a lot slicker. Like, there is a little bit more weight to it, and you can feel that. It just goes down the line faster. It feels more graceful, but it also feels more plush, especially on a longboard.
Foam doesn't have any natural flex built into it. There's nothing that really gives the foam a nice, gentle feel.
But if you were to try and build surfboards on the scale that foam boards are built with wood without some kind of a system in place, you know, they do the same thing to right. forests that yeah. they do to the stream up behind the foam plant. You know.
Right. You couldn't do it with wood.
You couldn't do it on that scale.
For those who can't afford to buy a custom wooden board, Mike and Rich offer build-your-own kits so surfers can experience the thrill of riding boards they built themselves.
They're great to surf, and they're great to look at. And, you know, you walk down the street, we can't get from here to the beach without 3 people stopping us and, you know, wanting to look at the boards and feel them, and people love them.
The experience of building your own board and dropping into a wave on it, you just can't, I mean, that's what keeps me doing it over and over again, is the fact that these things surf really well, and they're beautiful, and we made them, and you just can't beat that feeling, and that's what we're trying to share, is that experience.
For Only a Game, I'm Shannon Mullen in York, Maine.
Mom, if any of the guys from my baseball team ever call me on the phone to ask me to play in an important game, just say their captain ain't at home. Tell them I'm surfing.
Don't care about hitting home runs.
Tell them I'm surfing.
Wanna have me some fun, fun, fun.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Gabrielle Scruggs and Bill Littlefield. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Shannon Mullen's wooden surfboard photo gallery, learn more about Slap Happy, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for the newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. And our final word comes from Thomas Hackett, author of Slap Happy, Pride, Prejudice, and Professional Wrestling, when asked what Jane Austen would think of his book's rather derivative subtitle.
You know, I think she would appreciate it, actually. I think Jane has a sense of humor. She was known as Stone Cold Jane Austen, actually.
It's a good thing Hackett didn't pitch a subtitle from Louisa May, Bone Crusher Alcott. There would have been a hell to pay. I'm Charlie Pierce. Thanks for listening. I'll see you again next week in my usual chair. Thank the living God.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR, National